This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
My wedding day was very stressful, and well, I was going to be raped that night. I didn't know that at the time, but that's really what it is, because I'm forced to have sex with this man who I actually wasn't attracted to. Actually, we had nothing to say to each other, Andrew. We had nothing. You have to do this. You don't have a choice, because what you're told is that the marriage is only consummated if you have sex.
Hi again, I'm back for the third installment of the Andrew Gold podcast, and today I speak with Emily Green, who grew up in the Hasidic community, an extreme branch of the Orthodox or Haredi Jews. She's since set up Gesher EU, a European equivalent of the New York-based Footsteps, an organization that helps people leave the sect and start a new life. If you're interested, or if you are in such a community and have managed to use a secret computer with internet access, as Emily did herself, make sure to get in touch with her on geshereu.org.uk. That's geshereu.org.uk. So you know, next week I've got another riveting guest in the form of Justin Hall, the world's first ever blogger. So you could say he was patient zero in our social influenza. He had a fistfight with Kurt Vonnegut, posted the first ever dick pic, and had an online breakdown after everything spiraled out of control. So do subscribe to the channel to make sure you don't miss it. For now, though, Emily tells me what she thought of the Netflix sensation Unorthodox, which portrayed a Hasidic Jew escaping Brooklyn, New York, for Berlin, where I now live. If you haven't seen it, I recommend you do, but don't worry, there are no spoilers, and we don't talk about it for too long.
I thought they did a pretty good job, you know, doing it through the Yiddish and the actors. I think the producers really worked hard to get it really spot on. And they did to a large extent. It was brilliant for me to be able to kind of say to people, like, actually at work, and they were like, oh, we watched Unorthodox. And it's like, right, okay, so this is it. Like, I don't have to explain anymore. It's like, well, it's there. It's out there.
What stood out to you mostly that they really got spot on?
I think the meeting between Yanky and Esty the first time, the kind of the awkwardness, the atmosphere, the typical kind of conversation, was so brilliant. It was accurate. It was like, you know, reliving my own experience.
Yeah.
When I met my husband then for the first time.
Wow.
So in some ways quite therapeutic, like, okay, it's like a kind of, you know, you at the time I was young, you don't know what's happening. You just go along with it and you feel all these different feelings, and to see it out there, it's like, okay, I'm not crazy. This is real. This is, you know, because it is weird and it's not normal. Yeah. And watching it as on the eyes of a secular person, I can see now how bizarre it is.
I think one of the interesting things for me was that, because I'm from a very secular Jewish family as well, but I had a bar mitzvah, I learned to read Hebrew and a few things like that. And I think a lot of people, some friends said to me, you know, is that what your childhood was like? And I had to explain the difference. And I never met anybody in that community, I suppose, because it is so closed off. What is it like for the very, very few people in your situation who have actually been in it? What is it like around the TV room?
My older children remember when I was still living in the community and seeing it on the TV, it's like, oh my God, what is this? This is weird, you know? But then obviously, you know, they realized what this is and they got quite interested in it. So yeah, it was a very strange experience.
So did you stop it sometimes and say to your daughters, like, oh my God, this is like this or that? Or were there emotional parts for you bringing you back to something that I suppose you have mixed memories of?
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit strange. Like, I think the intimate scenes where Yanky and Esty have sex, and I think the one with the mikvah, and I think there's a shock, you know, I was like, you did that? Like it was like, I think a revelation. It was like, yes. And it was like, wow, okay.
Yeah. For our listeners who don't know, could you explain what a mikvah is?
When a woman has her period, she has to separate from her husband physically. So no physical contact is allowed at all. She has to check twice a day using these cloths, and you have to insert it into your vagina, really awful, to check that you're clean, you know, that you're not bleeding. And then after 7 days, when you have kind of, you know, that evidence that you've not, you know, your period is completely finished, you have to go to this place called the mikvah, which is like a ritual bath. You go in there after dark, you spend about an hour bathing yourself, and then you dip in there, you make a blessing, and then you have this woman who, the mikvah attendant, who watches you, which is extremely uncomfortable and violating, which I absolutely couldn't stand, and it's absolutely awful. And I think that's something, actually, I'm thinking about it, is not okay, especially for Jewish girls who are raised their whole life to cover their bodies, and then you're suddenly exposed and forced to do this on a monthly basis. It's awful. But the whole thing, they sell it to you as like it's a spiritually cleansing experience. And then once you've done that, you can come home to your husband and you're like pure, and you're kind of like, you know, you're allowed to resume having sex, and, you know, you can be intimate with each other.
I suppose it must make you feel ashamed of your body and dirty.
In the rest of your life as women, you're taught to be ashamed in the sense that you always have to cover your body, you know, wearing the wig and the sleeves and the, you know, you've got to wear those lengths, the necklines and the hemlines and all of it, as you saw Esty when she was still in Brooklyn. And then suddenly you're forced to completely naked in front of this stranger. So it all feels, it's really psychologically and emotionally damaging.
For somebody who's secular and doesn't know anything about that environment, how would you describe your childhood?
When I was 15, I picked up a code of Jewish law in English that was in my parents' house. Now, these kind of laws are only shared with women once, literally a couple of weeks before the wedding. Yeah. You're not told, you're not given sex education. That kind of information is completely taken out. It's considered inappropriate. So I was just reading it as a curious teenager. And then my mum finds me reading it and she goes completely ballistic with me. She's like furious, like, how dare you be reading this? And I was thinking, well, it's a code of Jewish law. Like, you would think that, you know, at school we studied Jewish law. So happened to be I was reading those chapters. So what's wrong with that? And then, of course, because it's forbidden, I'm going to continue to read it. And when I'm reading, I'm thinking, oh my God, no. This is something they did 100 years ago. Like, really? Like, you're starting to think, like, so my mum does this? Yeah, other than that, growing up, you know, you're like any kid, you just accept things that are normal, like, you know, this is how we dress, this is, you're also taught how proud and how amazing it is to be, you know, we're the chosen nation and God loves you and all that. So a lot of that kind of, you know, and you believe in it. So I think, you know, that was okay. Like, I never questioned anything, I think, till I was about 18 or 19 when I came close to having an arranged marriage. I think that's when it kind of started to kind of...
Yeah, when you said that your mother caught you reading and said, don't read, and it made you want to read more, I suppose you had a rebellious streak. Would that be fair?
I suppose, without realising. I didn't consider myself rebellious then, but maybe just curiosity. Looking back now, I know that there was lots of things I was deprived of, like not having, watching TV, or not lots of books. I couldn't go to the library. You know, lots of literature out there that... Like, I'm an English teacher now and I do loads of literature, and to think that I've missed out on a whole childhood of not reading. But, you know, again, you don't know what you're missing, really.
Is there a sense from some of the children, are they seeing other children who are allowed to play certain games or read books, as you say? Is there any sort of, oh, why don't we get to do some of that?
Not really. There's not for me. I mean, some people might grow up thinking that, but you don't really think about it too much. And what you're kind of brainwashed to believe that your life is kind of like, we're special, we're better than everyone else, and you're privileged to be living this lifestyle, and you're how lucky we are. So you do kind of buy that as a child, and because everybody around you is telling you that.
It's really interesting you say that, because I don't mean to be rude when I say this, but a lot of those people do come across to people outside of the group as a little bit arrogant sometimes. Just the movements, and I always wondered maybe that's just how people, how they walk and talk and things. But from what you're saying, it's there is genuinely a little bit of arrogance.
Yeah, I mean, that's 100%. If you read the prayers or some of it's all about we're the chosen nation, we're better than them, we're better than the non-Jews. Mm. And I have non-Jewish colleagues now, and I just laugh when I think about that narrative because it just doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're a child and you buy it.
Tell me about the language as well, because that's an interesting one, because I can't think of anything stranger for me than the idea of somebody growing up either in Brooklyn or in North London and not having a good grasp of English. Is it there's a difference between the men and the boys and the girls, is there, in learning English?
Yeah, absolutely. You're spot on. Because the boys, literally, especially the Hasidic boys, their education is limited to about 2 hours a day, roughly. And then their secular education generally stops completely at around age 11, 12. So most of them don't have more than a basic primary school level of reading or maths, writing and maths. Mm. Some of the boys will talk English at home, so their spoken language might be a bit better. Mm. So my brothers, for example, they've got an accent, like they sound like foreigners. Women, basically, we did our GCSEs. We didn't do A-levels, really. Sometimes some of the students went on to do A-levels independently, but it wasn't encouraged. Mm. Like when I was 16, I left school, we went to what was called a seminary where mostly a lot of the lessons were around kind of preparing us basically for an arranged marriage and to live a very holy kind of Jewish life. So the laws around practical aspects of running a Jewish home, like the dietary laws, etc. And that's it. Like, you know, so for me personally, I say I was lucky to have a career. I got my GCSEs, but then everything else after that I had to do independently. So let me be clear, the girls, by no means are they getting a full secular education. Most of the girls don't have A-levels, certainly are not allowed to go to a university.
Yeah, it does. It sounds so restrictive. And there's a Yiddish word, isn't there, for the person who sets you up to get married?
The shatran, yes. So when I reached the age of about 18, 19, my parents will get in touch with these like known men or women in the community who are known to, you know, be those matchmakers, and they will try to find a suitable family. And if they have a boy or girl of the same age, they will suggest that match to the parents. Usually the boy and girl will know nothing about it at that stage. In my case, they were looking for a boy. My father wanted somebody who was very devout. Mm. He would go to the yeshiva where the boys are and interview him as such. And it wouldn't be an interview about, are you going to be a good husband for my daughter? It would be an interview around how, you know, how good is his Jewish learning and knowledge, really. Mm. They booked an engagement hall, and just bear in mind, I hadn't even met him. I didn't even know who he was. The next week I met his parents. The boy's mother, you know, she was having a discussion, just sort of chit-chat. The men were making financial arrangements about the money, who's paying for what. Mm. And then the next week I met my husband-to-be. I met him on a Sunday night, and then we got engaged on Monday night. And that was it.
Do you feel like property in those moments?
Well, you don't know what you feel, really, because, you know, looking back, I would say yes. But at the time, no, because there's a lot of pressure to get engaged at a young age because all your friends are getting engaged. And if you don't get it, like if you're not married by the age of 22, 23, you're already considered like an old maid, like, you know, what's wrong with you? And you're an outcast and people feel sorry for you.
Yeah.
And they think that you've got a problem. So you want to fit in, so you want to get married, so there's something exciting about it. And obviously you've never met a boy, and you know, this like marriage, you know, you kind of every girl's dream, so you kind of hope and wish, you know. Yeah. So somewhere deep down there's this sense of like, oh my god, I actually don't even know this man, and you don't really pay attention because you kind of, you also want to please everyone around you.
I don't want to sound glib at all, but were you hoping he would be attractive?
No. It's interesting because I was telling my daughter the other day, because she's 16 and she's got, you know, typical teenager, boys and girls and all the politics that go in with it, yeah, and figuring out who you like and who you don't like. Yeah. And she was asking me, you know, mom, you know, and I was like, well, the first man, I didn't even talk to my teenage cousins.
Did you really not? You really didn't, you weren't allowed to talk to boys at all?
No, boy, you know, like if I'd go to my grandma's house, which is maybe where I'd meet them, it would be like they'd just look down at the floor. Hasidic boys particularly are very much brainwashed, like not to look at women, not to have any interactions with women, because God forbid they're going to be attracted to one. And then that, you know, obviously any sex, any kind of interactions with women outside of marriage is completely a no-no.
So your first conversation with your husband-to-be at that point, who you were going to get engaged with the following day, how did you feel?
You feel like it's not in your hands even, like it's not even in your control. So you're kind of looking for things that, like, hopefully you'll feel like, I can live with this man. The first conversation was terrible. It was just very tense, very similar to like Esty and Yonki. Second meeting was slightly more relaxed. But then at the end of it, he's proposing to me. And you're like thinking, I remember just like, well, what am I supposed to say? I mean, my grandma, my aunt, everyone's out there waiting for that, like, you know, they've got all the kids. They're waiting, like it's done. For them, it's done. They're told the whole family that I'm getting engaged that day. It was all sorted. So, you know, and it was almost like, I said to him, maybe he's a nice boy. I just don't know. And I was like, I don't feel like I'm ready to live with him. My dad was like, oh, everybody goes through it. Don't worry, it'll be fine. Don't worry, you'll get used to it. It'll be all right. So, and then my mum was like, look, you have to understand, you're only going to get older. He's a great boy. You're not going to get anything better. So to me, it was like, almost like, well, I'm going to turn this down. Who's to say the next one is going to be any better? Like I didn't feel I had any connection with him at all. I had no desire or interest. I remember he tried to call me during my engagement. I just used to pretend I'm sleeping, or I never came to the, I wasn't really interested.
He tried to call you. Are phones allowed and 3G and everything?
No, it was through the house line. Hmm. All he would do was give me a Torah, like a sort of Torah thought, like something that he'd learned that week.
So he'd call up and say just some interesting thing he'd learned from the Bible, like a love, like almost like a love extension.
No love, nothing about love.
Yeah. So you then, how long between the engagement and the marriage?
6 months for me.
And so those 6 months, were you starting to turn things over in your mind, or were you calm?
It was like this sense of like going on a train that you can't get off. Like you're just going on this journey and you just hope for the best, really. My wedding day was very stressful. And like as the wedding kind of went on, it was like this sense of like, now I can almost say to people like, well, I was going to be raped that night. I didn't know that at the time, but that's really what it is, because I'm forced to have sex with this man who I actually wasn't attracted to. Actually, we had nothing to say to each other, Andrew. We had nothing. It's all, you know, prescribed. You have to do this. You don't have a choice, because what you're told is that the marriage is only consummated if you have sex. So it's like this pressure, like, because otherwise you're not allowed to be alone in a house with him. So it's kind of this like part of the Jewish marriage. You have to, the completion of the marriage happens when the man and woman have relations, so you have to do it.
Is that that evening?
Yes.
It's like the end of the wedding, everybody knows what's about to happen and you go off. And
I remember at the end of the wedding standing outside the hall and wishing that I could just go to somebody's car and be whisked away far, far away. See, when you're going to be raped, that's how you're going to feel. No daughter of mine is going to ever experience that. That's just not going to happen, you know, like I'm going to do everything to prevent that, because I think that's you know, that's institutional rape. And you know, it's almost a sense of like all these people are around and they all know, they're all colluding in it. It felt like, it feels like it, but no, it's all very solemn and nobody, talks about it. Like it's not discussed.
Oh my word.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Richard Serrett. Join me on Strange Planet for in-depth conversations with the world's top paranormal investigators, alien abductees, Bigfoot trackers, monster hunters, time travelers, alternative archaeologists, remote viewers, and more.
As I was on the way to Area 51, I was stopping on the side of the road and just taking measurements, and I found this one spot where time slowed down by a fraction of a second. It's not supposed to do that.
From the two big categories, animal mutilations and human abductions, you have to conclude that genetic material is being harvested.
Well, I reached for a rifle, and I turned and looked, and it was already moving away, and it was descending the bluff. There's no way any human could have went down it. It was probably a 75-degree angle straight down, almost.
On Richard Serrett's Strange Planet, we're redefining reality. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Do not go any further. Turn around. Go home.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to be buried in an avalanche?
Weird foreign feeling of despair.
Or how it feels to crash a skydive?
I remember hearing a thud, feeling my body hit the ground.
Or how you would react if you were being attacked by an alligator?
At the end of my leg is this huge alligator head on my leg.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a victim of an attack.
Dragging me into the bathroom and saying, I'm going to kill you, now you're going to die.
You'll hear from a man who discovered a baby.
How could this be? How could there be a baby on the ground?
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Clinton County 911.
There's a man at my back door. He's trying to get in.
What Was That Like is a podcast about real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app or at whatwasthatlike.com.
When did you start to think back and think I was raped?
I read The Handmaid's Tale recently. I teach English A-level, there's chapter 16, and it's called The Ceremony, where the handmaid is forced to have sex with a commander. Yeah. And you read that chapter, and I read that chapter to my students, and I think, yeah, Margaret Atwood's got it right. This is what it's like. You know, when you get a perspective of what happens in the outside world and what's normal, I think that's when you can kind of start expressing, oh, okay.
I'm so sorry that you went through that.
Yeah, no, it's which is why I'm kind of quite passionate about speaking up about these things, because I feel like I didn't have that voice.
Yeah.
And I was forced to do things I didn't want to. I just was just reading this morning on Twitter, there's been a lot of criticism on Unorthodox, going back to that, where people are saying, Jewish people, oh, you know, we need to make another Unorthodox which shows the Haredi community in a positive light, because this is only going to encourage anti-Semitism.
Right.
And there's been a lot of backlash even from the Haredi community, and some people would see us as like completely deranged and crazy because we are calling up on these practices which are evil. In my opinion, they've just used the Bible as a justification to do evil, just control and power, really.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Do you have an opinion on that?
If people are saying, Unorthodox is unfair and it's going to make people anti-Semitic, that it makes me quite angry that people think that, because they should actually just be anti the Haredi community for the reasons that you are stating. That's my two cents on it.
No, that's interesting. But we have had a lot of people from the wider Jewish community who were very I've even had a meeting with Board of Deputies and people from there saying to us like, oh, you shouldn't be the one calling out on the practices that are wrong or evil in the community, because it's just going to cause, there's a fear non-Jewish people are going to suddenly see us as bad and it's not going to look good for our image. Evil is evil. It doesn't matter what it looks like or where it's found, really.
When they tell you that you shouldn't be calling it out because we might somehow be associated, the best way for us secular Jewish people to not be associated with it is by us calling it out and saying we are not them.
When people leave the community, the treatment that the Haredi community give those people, and a big example of that is people who leave with their children, what they do is they alienate the children. The women, the character that I mostly related to on that Unorthodox was Esty's mother. You know, coming to her own daughter's wedding and finding out the narrative that her daughter's been given about her, that she's abandoned her child when actually they filed for, you know, full custody and completely alienated and kept Esty away from her own birth mother.
Yeah.
And that is something that I experienced myself, and the community will do everything.
Yeah.
Recently, they had a Save the Children campaign. There's a woman we're supporting. She just wants to live in the wider Jewish community, put her children into Jewish schools, but not Haredi schools. She doesn't want to live,
yeah,
you know, with those restrictions and that lifestyle. And the community have set up a campaign to raise thousands and thousands of pounds to pay barristers and solicitors to fight for her ex-husband to make sure that he has full custody of the children, because she's not seen as a suitable parent because she's not religious anymore. Mm. They will get community members to speak to the children, make them say false allegations against the parent who is leaving the Haredi community. And unfortunately for me, my parents colluded with my ex-husband in being involved in that court battle. They didn't support me, they supported him. That was, like, unfortunately for me, that was the end of that relationship.
We should get back on track then, onto your life. So you got married, you had some children.
Yeah, so I got pregnant 6 weeks after my wedding. Mm. Looking back, I had no idea how young I was. Mm. I was only 21 when my daughter was born. And by the time I was 29, I had 5 children. And I think that was when I started to feel increasingly unhappy. I also was, I did a degree, and I did a master's through the Open University while I was sort of having my children. There was something, I guess, inside of me that was always interested about the outside world. And as the internet was kind of becoming a bit, you know, there was kind of expanding, there was more stuff online. I was just more interested.
I thought it was banned, the internet, in the Haredi communities.
It was. I was, I guess that's where I was rebellious. I just thought eventually I got Wi-Fi in the house. My husband had no knowledge of it.
He had no knowledge of the Wi-Fi in the house.
No knowledge. Well, to my advantage, my English, I dealt with all the bills and the, how, you know, I kind of...
How did you get the person to come over and do it all? Or did you do it yourself?
I think it was Talk. They sent me the box and the post, and there was a cupboard with our meter readings. So I just kind of plugged it in there, and I was just like, I don't even think he asked me, but I remember thinking, like, oh, I'll just say something to do with electricity, because I did all the meter readings. Oh, I sorted all of that out, all the bill, everything. So that was quite good. It gave me a window to another world outside of that community. And I think that, you may, as you grow older and later in my 20s, you just realize that there's something else outside. And then I started questioning, well, you know, like teaching Shakespeare, and I was in a Haredi school where we were not allowed to teach Romeo and Juliet. All the texts that I taught had to be checked through,
right,
you know, by other communities. So what's wrong? Why are we hiding knowledge from the kids?
How long does it take to start thinking, right, I'm out of this?
I think the thought was always there. I remember when I had my third child, a friend of mine was divorced, and I remember feeling really jealous of her, which is really strange. And I just researched into kind of what was kind of support out there for women in, you know, wanting to leave their marriage. I found Jewish Women's Aid. They gave me the idea that it's possible. I think my marriage at the same time became even more unbearable because it felt like I don't have to be putting up with all this.
You had a choice.
Yes. Yeah.
Was part of you sad about what it would, how it would hurt him, or that you would miss him, or anything like that?
Before we separated, and you know, the couple of nights before he left, he was really in tears, and really, it was hard. It was, and there was a sense of feeling sorry, but I also knew that I had given everything, and it was all at my expense and my misery that I'd given.
Yeah.
And it was just a sense of, well, you know, you have one life to live, and yeah. I think, yeah, I just had to feel like, it felt like this is the decision I had to make for me. I had to separate first, and my husband refused to leave the house. He was like, I'm staying here. And if anything, you're going to leave the house and leave the kids behind.
Okay.
That was not going to happen. I had a very kind rabbi who supported me at that point. And like I said, I was still very religious. I just wanted to get divorced. It was only after I got divorced that I started thinking, well, what kind of life do I want for myself and my children, that I realized I kind of started moving out of the Haredi community. 2 years, Andrew, I was stuck in a custody battle, trying to find and sort of think about a life outside of the community, because it just became basically untenable. Like, I'll give you an example. I was working in a Haredi school as a teacher, and I was basically asked to leave my job. I'd worked there as head of English department for 5 years. You know, overnight, I'd become this terrible woman who was doing terrible things.
And what was the situation then with your children?
So I was lucky. The courts obviously supported my decisions. They supported my application. So the children were able to live with me. It's this sense of my children not even knowing what could have been.
That's so funny. You must look at them every day and think, like, you know, how lucky it is that they don't have to grow up in that world.
Well, I don't think about it every day. I think there's some things we don't, but I do. No. Yeah. But, you know, there's definitely there. Oh, it's there. It's absolutely there in the background of that sense of my son is studying for his A-levels now, and knowing that he would be in a completely different place had I not left is there, of course. Absolutely.
When you left, did you remain in a more secular version of the Jewish community? Do you remain to this day religious in any way?
I call myself traditional, you know, like we'd do the Friday night dinner or the chagim, we'd celebrate, but it's in no way like religious based. Like, I feel like it's very much cultural, you know, like perhaps something similar to how you grew up, you know, your Jewish identity is part of who you are, but it's a very cultural rather than based on any religious beliefs.
Okay. That's nice. And, when you first left, so you were free, you were going to be less religious, but still part of the community. What was it like for you? Were you scared out in this world?
I think a lot of the struggles has been kind of to adjusting to kind of working in a secular environment. It is a sense that going into a new country, really, and trying to learn a new culture, really.
So what have you got any examples, like something that we wouldn't even think of that for you was quite new and fresh and weird?
I went to a job interview. It was very soon after I'd left the Haredi community. Now, in the Haredi community, you dress, you know, there's the standard dress of, you know, covered up and everything. So it was me experimenting, and I kind of, so I was wearing these trousers or jeans, now I know they were, and I didn't even, things that you don't know the difference between what is formal wear, informal wear. So I went to a job interview wearing jeans and this like flimsy, not even t-shirt, but like, I'm not even thinking about it. And then I didn't get the job, and I just thought, like, as an afterthought, to ask the head teacher why it was that, and he just was that on the phone, he was like, but did you even realize, like, saying in a really like angry tone, you dress completely inappropriately, like, that's, we can't employ you like that, you know, that. And it was like that, like, it was like somebody had hit me on the, like, slapped me on the face, like, oh my god, like. And then obviously I went out shopping, and it was like I bought myself formal clothes, and it's been, you know, obviously that kind of like lesson that I learned the hard way, really, because I had no idea.
That's incredible. Did you explain to this angry person why you weren't aware of that?
No, I didn't. I didn't even know what to make of it. I was really upset over something so stupid. Like this is ridiculous.
No.
How could I not have known? Like, the obvious, but I didn't.
Of course,
you know?
Not.
I don't know. Maybe if I would have been a bit smarter, I looked around a bit better. But it's all these things that I've constantly got to look around and think, okay, so that, you know, like, you know, what's normal, what's not normal. I'm always feeling like I'm just still learning to some extent.
How often, if ever, do you speak to your parents?
Well, strangely enough, I actually got in touch with my sister last week for the first time in 10 years. She was just a teenager when I left. So very strange experience. She's now married with 3 children and the same age as I was when I separated from my husband. She would like me to contact my parents, but for me personally, I've got this inner struggle. I just don't know. I don't want to be, you know, I need to kind of accept in a sense, but how do you accept it? And if it's going to be, you want to have a relationship with someone, you want it to be positive, but can it be, you know? So there's a lot of, it's obviously quite complex.
I think all of us grow up with this feeling of wanting to impress our parents and our siblings and for them to be proud of us. So is that very difficult for you, I suppose, knowing that nothing you ever do in this world can impress and make them proud?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They, like, to them, I let them down completely. Like, the good door, like almost like my sister, the way she was talking about me in the past, like, she'd idolized me. I was perfect in her eyes, you know, doing all the right things. And then suddenly, like, something went, like, almost like they see, like, I had a mental breakdown or something, you know, like, what happened to that person? And the way they see me now, I think for my sister, she's coming to terms with it. She's like asking me about my job and asking, trying to get a sense of what my life is like. So she's, you know, torn, I think. But there's always that sense of like, but, you know, I left that, I'm living a secular life. So, yeah, you're never going to be in their eyes, you know. And that's something difficult for both of us, I think, as well. Both of us, really.
When did you last speak to your parents?
It was 10 years ago, 10 years now.
Oh.
Yeah.
What would happen if you called them up now?
Well, I know my mother is trying to get in touch with me because she contacted somebody that I know and left this whole, wanted this woman to give this message to me, updating me and letting me know that she really is eager. And now my sister's obviously telling me, and my mother's been completely heartbroken. Like, she actually watched my mum breaking down in actual tears. Like, I lost my daughter, like, almost like as if a child of hers died. And, you know, I suddenly like recognize her pain, but also that sense of, but you weren't there for me and you betrayed me. And, you know, you caused this. So a conversation with her, it would probably be very stilted and awkward. I don't know, Andrew. I don't even have the answers.
Maybe one day.
Yes. Yeah. Older and wiser, and just kind of able to kind of be like, well, what they did is on them. And just kind of have the moral high ground.
Did you remarry then?
No, I mean, I don't know if I would ever get married again.
Okay.
But no, I would definitely, you know, getting into a relationship of my choosing and on my terms.
Would you go on the apps?
Definitely, yeah. Maybe you can recommend some, Andrew. I don't know. Yeah. I'll need to go on these single mom groups and say, right, guys, which ones work, you know?
Let me ask you, I don't mean to be glib or anything, but would you go on JDate, which for people who don't know is the Jewish dating app?
Yes, I think, I don't think I would narrow myself down to that, but I would definitely, consider that.
Okay.
You know, maybe sometimes the shared background, you know, might help. But from what I've seen, from just seeing people who have left the community like myself, there's been equally successful relationships, people with Jewish, non-Jewish.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes my conclusion is kind of like, it's down to the person, you know, if you connect to someone. But I'm definitely open to try that.
You started up Gesha EU. So what's the story?
I just had a sense that there must be people out there who, you know, like me, wanting to live a different life. But there was that sense, there was no support. There was Jewish charities like Jewish Women's Aid, you know, who were very helpful, even Norwoods, who supported me with my children. I also went on a trip to New York and found this organization called Footsteps. And for the first time, met lots of people like me who had been through the community. And it was absolutely exhilarating. It was like all these people who like got me and understood me and had similar stories to me. And there was that sense of, we have to have something here in the UK. And why isn't there something in the UK? We had our first meeting in December 2012. 30 people showed up, and it was literally from there. And I think mainly the thing is, when you leave that community of support, you lose your friends, you lose your family, you lose all those connections that you take for granted growing up. So Gesha kind of aims to replace a lot of that. And also some of the basic things like helping, you know, with education or navigating the court process, you know, people leaving a community where you don't know much about the outside world, telling people that how to dress for an interview. So, you know, if whatever it is that, you know, so that they have that support, that network there for them.
Yeah. I like the idea that there's somebody a little bit like you 10 years ago, or how you were, you know, in the community now with Wi-Fi secretly installed, who's watching this conversation and thinking, oh, I better go to Gesha EU now. And
maybe that's the way I kind of deal with what the kind of anger. And I think when I was finished with all of the process of leaving, it was almost like, I know why people don't leave, because it's so damn difficult. It really, really is. Like, it comes at you from all angles. And I knew it would be very, very difficult, but I don't think I realized. I mean, just go, it's like, it's traumatic. Like, I haven't even like been able to, we need another video to talk about all the challenges that, you know, from financial to practical to, you know, fear of losing your children and everything that's taken from you, and the way the community will do everything to make sure that you fail, that you're not successful. You know, my dad was like, you're going to end up in a mental institution. And you know, you do, like, I consider myself a strong woman, mentally strong, physically. And those moments of like, you know, they do that. They really do that. And whatever their reasons, they probably don't want people to leave. So that kind of being able to resolve that through the charity, maybe there's that part of it where you feel like, well, nobody should go through what I had to go through. Well, they are going to, but maybe let's make sure that it's not as difficult.
Yeah.
You know, that they're not doing it alone. So I think that's the motivation, I think, in any case.
So last question here. Do you miss being part of the community? And if so, what do you miss?
I mean, yeah, like talking to my sister, and I know that somewhere, you know, it does, there's the losses there, you know, this, whether it's the songs or the bits of it that we did enjoy, like being together as a family, you know, but there's also that sense of like, but I can't go back there, you know, wow. I'm living in the present. So, yeah.
And it sounds like you're doing a good job of living in this present. I'm happy you're on our side now.
No regrets, definitely.
If you listened this far, it leads me to believe you're interested in this kind of content, in which case, please do subscribe on the podcast app, leave a review, a good one, hopefully. Also, go subscribe to my YouTube page for the video version, where you'll find photos of Emily from when she was in the community. It was fascinating speaking to her. She's a really lovely, wonderful person. I even went to see her in her house, and she welcomed me in, and she was very nice. And please do visit geshaeu.org.uk. If you're looking to find my YouTube page, by the way, which is not always that easy, I'll be linking to it on andrewgold_OK on Twitter. It's the same as my Instagram handle. That's a lot of social media pages, but if you get to Twitter, andrewgold_OK, you'll find about a bazillion links to the YouTube page and to this very podcast, which you're already on, so that won't be of much use to you. See you next week when I'll be with Justin Hall, the first ever blogger. And he had a fight with Kurt Vonnegut, the writer. And it's one hell of a story.